Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's 2013 budget plan unveiled today and speak about it with Thomas Ferguson, who is on the board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. We will discuss what is not an austerity budget, but one that calls for more taxes on the rich and therefore has no hope of Republican support, but might persuade American voters that it is the path back to economic health. Then, with Greece teetering on default as violent protests leave 45 buildings in Athens burning, we will examine the latest round of austerity measures voted on by an unpopular parliament to ensure a second EU bailout. Kostas Panayiotakis, a professor of sociology at the City University of New York, joins us to discuss how the devastated Greek economy can generate revenues and whether Greece's creditors, the French and German banks, are prepared to take a 90% haircut. Then finally, on a day that an Apple share tops $500, we will look into working conditions in China where Apple's products are assembled. Arun Gupta, the founding editor of the New York City-based independent newspaper, joins us. He has an article at Alternet, iEmpire, Apple's sordid business practices are even worse than you think. I'm now joined by Thomas Ferguson, who is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
And the president unveiled his new 2013 budget today, which includes $1.5 trillion in new taxes, allowing the Bush-era tax cuts to expire. It also includes the Buffett rule, a tax hike on millionaires, as well as infrastructure programs. Altogether, $3.8 trillion plan, but one that is not, the White House insists, is not an austerity budget. And given the tax raises on the wealthy, wouldn't that indicate that this is dead on arrival with the Republicans?
Oh, it's dead on arrival for many reasons. That's certainly a good one. I mean, you also... You've got large numbers of, the super rich who also oppose not only the taxes, but the spending. And, yeah, there's, look, yes, I mean, let's just for a second sort of walk through this sort of, I think you basically got the right framework there, Ian. I mean, this is an election year budget, and as such, it's very different from what we've been hearing from the president. I mean, there's relatively less emphasis on closing the deficit, which was, frankly, he spent the entirety of 2011 and sort of much of when it counted in 2010 pushing on that theme. That sort of receded. And then, you know, it's rather like a lot of other things the administration's been doing, where, you know, they pushed back that Keystone Pipeline. They've been hyping this mortgage agreement, which, so far as I can tell, is actually pretty terrible. And they're doing a bunch of things that make it sound like, finally, they're doing something for the average American. I mean, these guys, you know, the one's first reaction to this, I have to tell you, is, geez, where have they been for the last 3 years? But, you know, even this budget, while it's better than the other, I mean, at least it asks for some taxes from the rich instead of simply cutting them again, which is, of course, what the president did right after the election in 2010 when he was, you know, running all through the election. He was saying, well, he didn't want to extend those tax cuts for the super rich. And then he turns around right after it and does it. And, you know, now he is asking for that. He's also asking for the I was just looking at the budget just before I got on here. You know, he's also asked for the repeal of that ludicrous carried interest provision, which allows private equity firms to sort of treat their work income, you know, as some kind of investment income instead of what it is for the rest of us.
Right. They pay 15% if they pay anything at all. And that is what Mitt Romney's been a beneficiary of among other private equity head fund managers.
Yes, look, one has to say here that I think the Romney candidacy, whatever else it's done, has been a great education for the population. I suspect that a lot of people have suddenly now come to understand how the tax code works. In that sense, I think the president's likely to help himself a little bit with this. But, you know, as you say, it is dead on arrival. It's not going to happen. The plain fact of the matter is that, you know, this is the only time we've been hearing this from him, really, in a sort of concentrated manner. So forgive me if I don't turn handsprings. And I have to comment, too, it's like the White House still refuses to grasp the fundamental problem. You know, the fundamental problem is that well over 8% of the workforce, I mean, really maybe closer to 16 or 17%, with a lot of folks dropping out of the workforce, so they're not counted at all, is unemployment. And after three years on the job, these folks have still not proposed anything that is going to make a really big dent in that. And yes, their budget is different from the Republicans, who do nothing at all on that. But it's becoming crazy. I mean, anybody who could stop and think about this for 5 seconds could realize it can't make sense to just keep paying people to be unemployed. It would be much cheaper and much better for everybody if they were paid to work. I mean, you know, these guys, the White House here, they look good only compared to the Republicans.
And Thomas Ferguson, again, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking, and a contributing editor to The Nation. The president says this is not about class warfare. It's about national or the nation's welfare. Do you think there's a chance then, given the gridlock Congress, that he can persuade the American voters, many of whom are very upset and anxious, one in four homes are underwater? Do you think he can make the case that this is the best way back to prosperity, while the Republicans and the push the Ryan plan and bring back the specter that we're broke, and try to make the analogy between the federal debt and the personal debt, and that this is the big problem we face, not unemployment, and not the recession.
Yeah, he might, you know, if people are listening to the argument, he'll probably win it against the Republicans. The problem is a lot of folks may not listen too much to the argument. They will simply compare what's actually happened over the last 3 years, which is also, frankly, a rational point of view. And there they're likely to conclude that the president's fallen short. So I think this is going to be something of a problem. I also think when you look into that budget, you can see some really foolish things, of which, you know, the cuts in defense actually are really pretty small. They come mostly from just the withdrawal from Iraq and the beginnings of withdrawal in Afghanistan. You haven't had any fundamental effort to try to sort of sort through what the U.S. actually could afford to spend on defense and what it needs. Just look at that huge open-ended commitment to the Pacific defense, that the perimeter that the president, you know, announced a couple of months ago when he went out to Australia. I mean, you know, anybody who thinks about this for 5 seconds realizes that 500 or 2,500 Marines sitting in Australia are not going to deter anybody from doing anything. I mean, in some fundamental sense, those Marines' guns are pointed not at the Chinese, but at Mitt Romney. They're there to defense the claim that the president hasn't done enough, from the usual "we must spend everything on defense" crowd. That tends to completely dominate the Republicans and has a big chunk of the Democrats. But, you know, they're not confronting the fundamental reality here, which is, you know, the huge threat to American defense in the medium run is the low rate of economic growth in the United States. It's sort of the flip side of the unemployment problem. You can spend all the money you want putting aircraft carriers or Marines out in the Western Pacific, but every year what's going to happen, and what has been happening, is the sort of the growth of the Chinese economy makes them more and more friends and clients in all those neighboring countries. And in 5 or 10 years, it simply will not matter how many, you know, bristling military forces you've got sitting there. It's just everybody will be doing business with the Chinese because the American economy just withers away. This is like a total failure to get the point. Instead, the Americans keep sending, you know, Kurt Campbell out there, the Assistant Secretary for Asian, basically just talks tough. This doesn't make any sense. This is a losing hand. It can't win.
Thomas Ferguson, let me touch on a couple of or several of the points in this budget that was unveiled today before a bunch of students in Virginia. The president says that we're going to save $41 billion over 10 years by closing tax loopholes for oil, gas, and coal companies. That's popular, although that's the most powerful lobby in Washington. They're up there with them, right?
We won't argue.
Right. Then he says we can generate $61 billion over 10 years through a tax on financial institutions to recover the costs of the bailout. That sounds good. Again, you're up against the bank lobby. Saving $25 billion over 11 years and spending cuts for the Post Service. I mean, the Postal Service being devastated by ludicrous congressional restraints on them to prepay all of their pensions for 75 years.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know why he's going after the post office. It's a complete catastrophe what the Congress has done to the post office. Then you've got cutting spending on health care by $364 billion. That's ambitious, and it's going after the vendors. Investing $476 billion in infrastructure projects. That's a spending thing. With $50 billion immediate cash for transportation, $30 billion to upgrade schools, $30 billion to hire teachers, police, and firemen. So the last one is the antithesis of an austerity budget, right?
Well, if it's the antithesis of an austerity, it's more like a small gesture.
Right. But again, no snowball's chance in hell.
Yeah, we probably ought to just say a word about this college tuition business. I mean, basically, that's just another example of the kind of utterly fraudulent liberalism that you're now peddling there. I mean, the fundamental issue in American education, higher education in particular, is that the state and the government pay less and less as a percentage of the total cost. Now, it's fine to tell colleges to sort of restrain their tuition, but, you know, what are they supposed to do as their costs rise? What they need is some serious federal programs there. Students don't need help in loans. They need help in paying for college there. And, you know, nothing the president's talking about is going to do very much about this problem. And the one effective thing they could do to force some really serious comparison shopping among colleges on the basis of real information around them, they make only gestures in. And this is pure claptrap. It's pure junk.
Well, but Tom Ferguson, let's face it, the government does spend up, I think it's around $40 billion of our taxpayer money on for-profit education, which is a complete racket. It's now ending up becoming the new subprime bubble. Wall Street's getting in on the act. They take federal dollars, give them to these phony shingles. They sucker, just like they did with the subprime housing, they sucker minority students and vets in there, saddle them with a monstrous debt, and give them a worthless diploma. And that's a complete bipartisan scam.
Well, not quite. That's been, in truth, Ian, that's been more. John Boehner was the big champion of that in the House. It was he who was pushing the sort of efforts to cut early in the Obama administration. The administration made a couple of efforts. I have to say this for them. They did try to rein in the privates. They've had Republican opposition every step of the way. I mean, and that it's not totally by. I wouldn't.
Right. Well, there are a lot of lobbyists from on the Democratic side, like the former Senate Majority Leader and others, that are lobbying for the for-profit schools. The Washington Post Company, of course, it makes all of its money from Kaplan, a for-profit school.
Yep. I'm not disagreeing. We're not in any disagreement
right.
here on this.
But we, I'm surely agree that it's one of the most egregious. Absolutely disgraceful wastes of federal money, and it's immoral how kids are ripped off with taxpayer money. That money could be going towards what you were just saying earlier, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would add that the way the sort of keep letting the private finance folks, banks, and others into the college lending, where they mark up the loans way up, when the government can do that very cheaply and does a very good job on that. I mean, that has been, yeah, that's just, it's like the craziest national education policy anyone could possibly design. It's really nuts.
Well, just in closing, Tom Ferguson, given that this, we're sort of talking about the big headline today, which is sort of meaningless. I hate doing this because, you know, I'm trying to find out what's really going on in the world, and this just feels like such theater because you've got a completely gridlocked and obstructionist Congress,
right.
And you got an election year. And I guess the president, you know, he can't get anything passed in the Senate unless he has 60 votes.
Right.
I mean, that's a surreal usurpation of power that, I don't know, nobody seems to talk about it, but...
Look, well, you don't want me to get started. This is only a 15-minute interview. I mean, I do a fair amount of work on this. Huh. We know we have the best Congress money can buy, and yes, that results in... sort of partisan gridlock. You know, this is not coming from voters. I mean, this is just idiotic to claim that voters really want that. They don't. How many minutes would you like to give me to sort of excoriate this whole thing? Yeah, look, I regret to say that this is one of those moments when you just look at the democratic process and you want to just put your head in your hands and cry, or just try to dream of something else for a few minutes. Because this is a tale told of full of sound and fury, and it signifies nothing.
Well, I think Macbeth, the quote from Macbeth is a tale told by idiots, isn't it?
I did deliberately drop. A lot of these people are very able. They know exactly what they are doing.
Right. And we, the people, are getting the great shaft. Well,
I thank
you for joining us here, Tom. We're going to try and get hold of your documentary, too. We're hoping to have it here today as a premium.
It's about
Golden Rule, the book that you've written, which really explains how the power of money has supplanted the power of people, right?
Yeah, I have to say, my usual injunction here, if you want a happy ending, see a Disney movie.
Well, thank you for joining.
This is a problem.
Thank you for joining us here today, Thomas Ferguson.
Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He is the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems.